Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is December 13th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Don't Stand So Close to Me, You Have the Flu. We have a guest skeptic all the way from Norway. Marcus Prescott is a nurse and it works at Trondheim University St. Olaf's Hospital. His college thesis was called Barriers and Facilitators to the Implementation of Evidence-Based Practice Among RNs in Specialized Healthcare. Marcus is also a proud member of the Norwegian Skeptics Society and runs their Skeptics in the Pub event. Sounds like good foam. Welcome to the SGEM, Marcus.
Thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wait a minute, hold up. You don't sound Norwegian.
Well, I'm not really. I'm an Irish citizen and with an English mother and American father.
Oh, so you're an international man of mystery, are you?
Yes, or confused.
Well, I also understand, and you probably heard this in our introduction, that you're a big skeptic. Have you always been skeptically minded?
Not always, but for most of my adult or semi-adult life. Yes, I started becoming skeptical, I think, around the time of my daughter's birth in 2008, and never went back.
Now, I understand you have a connection to McMaster University, the home of evidence-based medicine.
Yes, I do. My uncle actually attended McMaster back in the 80s, and he is actually something of an EBM guru in Norway now. So
you come by it honestly. It's in your genes, is it?
Yeah, you might say so. My mother works as a medical researcher as well, so it's all in the family.
Now, Marcus, you contacted me via email in September asking me if I was planning on doing a flu episode given the April 2014 Cochrane update on Tamiflu. And of course, I said, hey, yes, sure, sounds like a great idea, which I think really demonstrates the power of foam and social media.
It really does. And of course, we both got to reading this 556-page Cochrane review. And suddenly...
It wasn't so fun anymore, was it? It was like, oh, are you kidding me? It's 500-plus pages, Marcus.
Yeah, I actually read through most of it back in April, but I didn't bother to read through all the analyses. And I realized in October that that's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work, but, you know, that partially explains why it took us from September until December to organize this podcast. But despite the huge manuscript, it was still fun searching out appropriately themed music from the 1980s, which we eventually decided on that great song by The Police, Don't Stand So Close to Me, which would, of course, be good if you've got a contagious infection like influenza.
Yes, definitely, Ken. And if you have the flu, I'm glad you're on Skype and not that close to me.
Well, let's start the show with a common case presentation for this time of year. Can you give us a case, Marcus?
A 25-year-old ENT nurse with no significant past medical history presents to the ED with a 48-hour history of aching all over, fever, and a cough. He did not get a flu shot this year, and you diagnose him with a flu-like illness. You provide him with advice on management and set expectations. However, before leaving the emergency department, he wants to know if taking one of those flu drugs he sees on telly will help.
That is an excellent case to get this show going. But let's bring everybody up to speed with some background information, some material, before we start with the critical review.
Yeah, great.
So influenza, it's a seasonal phenomenon, and we've covered this before on the SGEM number 20 when we discussed mandatory immunization for healthcare workers.
Yes, and second to flush toilets, immunization has been one of the most significant advances in modern medicine. And as you know, some vaccines have been highly successful. You have the Haemophilus influenza B, you have smallpox, you have polio. Others, again, have not been that successful, such as the attempts at making the HIV vaccines. And others, again, have worked well but are losing their efficacy, such as the whooping cough vaccine.
And it's the flu vaccine. It's one of the ones that it really isn't highly effective. And there's a number of reasons why it's not so effective. However, there was a Cochrane review that showed vaccinating healthcare workers, in addition to other preventative interventions, might protect elderly in long-term care facilities.
Yes, and The evidence contained in that review was not that great and it did have a high risk of bias. But as you pointed out in that episode, I think it was, yes, number 20, EBM does have its limitations, and sometimes the best evidence is not that great. But despite the limited data, it is recommended healthcare workers get a flu shot.
Absolutely.
Get a flu shot. I'm Pat Doc.
This podcast is going to focus on treatment options, though, after you've been diagnosed with the flu, rather than preventing it in the first place. Neuraminidase inhibitors are influenza antiviral drugs often used to treat patients with the flu. Many governments stockpiled these drugs with the H5N1 scare of 2005 and increased their supply after the 2009 H1N1 pandemic.
Yeah, but at the time there were concerns that these drugs were not as effective as they were promoted to be. And much of the skepticism came from all the data not being available to analyze.
So what's the clinical question we hope we can answer on today's episode of The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine?
The clinical question is, do neuraminidase inhibitors benefit patients with influenza?
And the reference?
That would be Jefferson et al., Neuraminidase Inhibitors for Preventing and Treating Influenza in Healthy Adults and Children, Review, 2014. It's available from the Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews.
It's at this point in the podcast, Marcus, that we go through the PICO statement. That stands for Population Intervention, Control or Comparison, and the Outcome. So what was the population they were looking at in this Cochrane Systematic Review?
Well, this review included 20 oseltamivir or Tamiflu trials with 9,623 participants and 26 Relenza or zanamivir trials with 14,628 participants. Now, these participants were previously healthy people of all ages, and previously healthy includes people with chronic illness, such as asthma, diabetes, or hypertension, but excludes illnesses with more significant effects on the immune system, such as malignancies or HIV.
And what was the intervention then in these studies?
The intervention was neuraminidase inhibitors, that is oseltamivir or zanamivir, administered by any route.
And what did they compare it to?
They compared it to placebo, but it is worth noting that these placebos might actually contain active substance.
And then they had outcomes. They had both primary outcomes and secondary outcomes. Let's go through, what were their primary outcomes that they were concerned with?
Well, in the treatment studies, the primary outcomes were symptom relief, pneumonia, and hospitalization. For prophylaxis studies, it was influenza or influenza-like illness, household transmission, and hospitalization. For both of these, of course, it was important with harms of the treatment, such as nausea, vomiting, cardiac effects, or psychiatric effects.
And then they had some secondary outcomes. Can you just go through those quickly?
Yes. For the treatment studies, the secondary outcomes were symptom relapse after finishing treatment, drug resistance, viral excretion, and mortality. For the prophylaxis studies, this was drug resistance, viral excretion, and mortality.
So the author's conclusions from this Cochrane systematic review was, oseltamivir and zanamivir have small nonspecific effects on reducing the time to alleviation of influenza symptoms in adults, but not in asthmatic children. Using either drug as prophylaxis reduced the risk of developing symptomatic influenza. Treatment trials with oseltamivir or zanamivir do not settle the question of whether the complications of influenza, such as pneumonia, are reduced because of the lack of definitions. The use of oseltamivir increased the risk of adverse events such as nausea, vomiting, psychiatric effects, and renal events in adults and vomiting in children. The lower bioavailability may explain the lower toxicity of zanamivir compared to oseltamivir. The balance between the benefits and harms should be considered when making decisions about the use of both of these for either the prophylaxis or treatment of influenza. The influenza virus-specific mechanism of action proposed by the producers does not fit the clinical evidence, end of quote. Whew, that's a long conclusion, isn't it, Marcus?
Oh, God, you must be dry mouth.
Well, it's just like the actual review itself, that being over 500 pages, I'm not surprised the whole conclusion is like more than a paragraph.
Yes.
Let's go through the quality checklist. There's 7 questions as a quality checklist to probe for bias and things in systematic reviews. So let's go through those 7 questions. The first question, Marcus, was the clinical question, is it sensible and answerable?
I would say it was.
Number 2, the search for studies, was it detailed and exhaustive?
Yes, it's probably the most exhaustive search I've ever seen.
And one of the most exhausting searches or most exhausting studies I've ever read.
Definitely.
Number 3, the primary studies, were they of high methodological quality?
No.
The assessment of the studies, were they reproducible?
They were.
Number 5, the outcomes were clinically relevant?
Yes.
Number 6, was there low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcomes?
No, there was not.
Okay, so they were heterogeneous. Number 7, the final question. The treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Unfortunately, no.
Ah, no. So this means we got to dig into those results. So let's do that now. We'll go through the primary outcomes first and the primary outcome of treatment. So when the primary outcome of treatment, when it came to symptom relief, can you tell us what the results were?
It was. Both oseltamivir and zanamivir reduced symptoms in adults, but by less than 1 day.
Yeah, I think it was like 16.8 hours and 14.4 hours, respectively.
Yes, and oseltamivir also reduces symptoms in children, but by over 1 full day. Unfortunately, not in asthmatic children.
And this was only 1 trial, I believe, and it was the 1 trial that showed a decrease of symptoms of about 29 hours.
Yes. For zanamivir, it did not have any significant effect in children.
How about when it comes to primary outcomes in the treatment trials, how about for hospitalizations?
Unfortunately, zanamivir did not report hospitalizations, and there was no effect found in rates of hospitalization for oseltamivir.
So if you treated people with oseltamivir, it did not decrease the number of hospitalizations, correct?
It did not.
All right. How about pneumonia? Because that's always been a concern. Did it decrease the rate of pneumonia?
Well, this is where it gets interesting, Ken, because oseltamivir actually reduced the risk of investigator-mediated unverified pneumonia with an NNT of 100.
I love the fact that you're on a podcast and he's doing air quotes, people. Investigator-mediated. Can you explain that to the people who can't see you?
Well, the thing is that once you started looking at the diagnostic criteria or radiological confirmation of pneumonia that was actually detailed in the trials, this effect disappeared.
So there was not a significant change or a significant difference in number of pneumonia with detailed diagnostic criteria or radiologically confirmation of pneumonia. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, exactly.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, they give this NNT of 100, and then you drill down into this big project, into this big document, and you find out that they're really, you know, it was messy. It was a little difficult. It was not so clear. How about in pediatrics?
Well, unfortunately, oseltamivir did not influence the likelihood of pneumonia in pediatric patients.
What about zanamivir? Did it work?
No, unfortunately.
So what you're saying is that there may be an NNT of 100 when it comes to using oseltamivir reduced investigator-mediated unverified pneumonia, but it did not have an effect in children, and zanamivir did not affect X-ray confirmed pneumonia in children.
This is correct.
All right. How about primary outcomes from the prophylactic studies? Were either of these drugs able to prevent influenza or influenza-like illnesses?
It does look like it. Oseltamivir and zanamivir both significantly reduce the risk of symptomatic influenza in any individual by an NNT of 33 and 51, respectively.
How about preventing household contacts and transmission between household contacts?
Yes, actually, you saw an effect of for both oseltamivir and zanamivir. And they reduce the risk by, with an NNT of 8 and 7, respectively.
How about, did it have an effect on asymptomatic transmission of influenza?
No.
All right. in these prophylactic studies, could you prevent hospitalizations?
Oseltamivir did not have an effect on the rates of hospitalization. Post-exposure prophylaxis could not be assessed because of poor trial methodology.
So we've been talking about some of the potential benefits to using these drugs when it comes to influenza, but we've always got to consider the balance of harm. Were there any harms identified in these treatments?
Yes, there was, Ken, actually. Now, for zanamivir, we saw no increase in adverse events, but there were some adverse events reported for oseltamivir.
Well, can you go through those with us then?
Yes, of course. First of all, you have nausea and vomiting, and you increase both with a number needed to harm of 22 in adults, and vomiting you increase with a number needed to harm of 19 in children. It did, however, decrease diarrhea with an NNT of 43, yes, 43.
So what you're telling me, Marcus, is if you give this medication, you had more coming out the top end, but less coming out the bottom end.
That would be nice. Unfortunately, it seems that the active substance contained in the placebos might cause diarrhea.
Ah, so if you were getting the placebo, you would get more diarrhea. So in comparison, if you were in the active treatment group, you would have a decrease in diarrhea, and that may be responsible for the number needed to treat of 43. Is that what you're getting at?
It might. It's difficult to assess.
Okay, well, how about any other effects? Were there any other harms?
Well, there might have been some cardiac effects. It looks like it does reduce cardiac events with an NNT of 148, but it might also increase QTC prolongation with a number needed to harm of 25. But it's a bit iffy.
All right. Any other ones that you wanted to talk about as harms?
Yes. There are possible psychiatric effects. If these are there, they are dose-related. And though you didn't find any significant effect in treatment trials, there was a significant effect in the prophylaxis trials with a number needed to harm of 94.
So there was a number of secondary outcomes, which we will put in the show notes, but not discuss on today's episode. Otherwise, you would have a 45-minute podcast. So why don't we skip with those secondary results? If you're interested, you can go to the blog and check those out. But let's move on and provide some commentary on this 500-plus page document.
Great. Let's do that.
All right. Well, rather than reviewing only easily accessible and published data, the reviewers managed to get a hold of a full clinical study reports, or CSRs, from regulators and industry. This allows for full statistical reanalysis and assessment of bias. In turn, it gives a more complete and accurate picture of the evidence.
Yeah, and CSRs are quite interesting. They're the intermediate stage between the full raw data collected from a clinical trial and the summarized article published in the journals, the ones that you and I actually read. And they contain all this information needed to conduct data analysis on data and to review the biases and, of course, to draw conclusions. They do, however, not include confidential patient information other than certain relatively easily redacted appendices. And though I think you and I would agree that these should be public property, they are often, even usually, withheld.
Oseltamivir and zanamivir were licensed for marketing by the FDA and the EMA around the turn of the millennium. Though they at first did not sell well, the H5N1 avian influenza outbreaks quickly brought this drug to blockbuster levels. And since their licensing, the governments of the world have accumulated stockpiles for over, and you know what, Marcus, I can't say this without putting my pinky to the side of my mouth and say, $9 billion.
That's a ridiculous amount of money. And the stockpiling was based on these earlier claims that NIs might reduce the time to alleviation of symptoms, but more importantly, reduce the risk of complications. And if I may quote Ben Goldacre on this, complications are a medical euphemism for pneumonia and death.
Well, the 2006 version of this review by Jefferson supported these claims, showing limited effects on time to first alleviation of symptoms and, quote, complications. The authors advised against use in regular influenza seasons, but supported use in endemic and pandemic settings.
Yes, and However, during the influenza A H1N1 2009 pandemic outbreak, several governments commissioned an updated review from the Cochrane Collaboration. And talking about social media, during this work, a Japanese pediatrician wrote a comment, not in a journal or in a letter or anything, but in the comment section underneath the review, where he pointed out that most of these results were based on only one industry-run meta-analysis of 10 studies. And of those 10, only two had actually been published.
Somebody started getting suspicious.
Yeah, quite a few, actually. And the team started investigating trial registries, ERBs, or ethical review boards, and, of course, regulatory documents. And they found that there were several missing trials, partly missing trial programs, and generally a lot of missing data.
Well, inquiries by the Cochrane team were made to access the missing data, but for several years, both industry and the relevant regulators continued to withhold the data. When they finally relented, the Cochrane team reviewed 2.2 gigabytes of data and regulatory comments to arrive at the reviewed published in April 2014.
Yeah, and as we've seen the main results they presented, they actually differed quite significantly from what was seen in the published data.
The effects of the neuraminidase inhibitors in the treatment or prevention of influenza is in part difficult to assess because of major possible sources of bias in these trials.
Yes, there was generally incomplete outcome data for symptoms, complications, and safety data, and a high degree of selective reporting. Many studies lacked random sequence generation, and blinding of participants and personnel was inadequate in most of the trials. The reviewers also report a generally high risk of other biases. Only allocation concealment and blinding of outcome assessment could be considered generally adequate.
Other commentaries have been done about this Cochrane review and can be found at Science-Based Medicine and EM Lit of Note with Dr. Ryan Radecki. Excellent website, everybody. Check out EM Lit of Note. Anyways, I'd like to take this opportunity, Marcus, to get you to comment on the author's conclusions and compare it to some of the conclusions that we've been making.
Well, I'd say the conclusions are reasonable, given all the difficulties and limitations with the data provided.
How about a bottom line, though? Can you give an SGEM bottom line on this?
In children and adults treated with neuraminidase inhibitors, oseltamivir or zanamivir, there is a significant reduction of time to symptomatic improvement. This effect was not seen in asthmatic children. Though the effect is statistically significant, it may not be clinically significant. It is currently unclear whether this is superior to commonly used antipyretics.
The evidence does not support claims of reduction in risk of major or minor complications, hospitalizations, or death in healthy individuals or in individuals with higher risks of complications, such as children with asthma or the elderly. The prophylactic effect seems minimal.
It does, and unfortunately, NIs increase the risk of adverse events, such as nausea, vomiting, and perhaps psychiatric effects.
So when balancing the possible risks and possible benefits, the evidence does not support routine use of these drugs for the treatment or prevention of influenza in any individual. And Marcus, I think that has to be the longest bottom line in the SGEM's history, but it's probably the longest article I've also ever reviewed. How about a case resolution? You started this off with a case. Can you resolve the case?
Yes. You would send the ENT nurse home and tell him to stay home from work, drink plenty of fluids, take over-the-counter medications for aches and pains, wash his hands well, cover his mouth when he coughs, and consider getting that flu shot next year. And please don't stand so close to me.
Yes, I don't want this either. How about from a clinical application standpoint? How are you going to apply this clinically in practice?
Well, the evidence does not support routine use of neuraminidase inhibitors in the treatment of influenza. The benefit of prophylactic use is debatable when balanced against the risk of adverse events. It is worth noting, though, actually important noting, that exceptions might exist in compassionate cases.
So here's what I tell patients then. This drug may reduce the length of time you are sick with the flu, by about a day. But it also may make those days worse with more nausea and vomiting.
I'd say that is exactly what I'd tell a patient.
This brings us to the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Scott Kobner from New York School of Medicine. Scott knew that the largest kidney stone ever removed, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, was 13 centimeters. I am not optimistic that you could take enough Tamsulosin to pass a 13 centimeter kidney stone. But what's the question this week, Marcus?
Well, the question for this week's Keener contest is, what was the name of the 1918 flu pandemic?
If you know the answer to this week's Keener or Gunner question, then send me an email with Keener or Gunner in the subject line to thesgem@gmail.com. The first person to correctly answer the question should receive a cool skeptical prize before the end of the year. Now, don't forget to sign up for Ski Beam in January. It's the 26th and 28th in BC. And then there is the Shock and Resuscitation Conference in Montreal this spring, May 1st to 3rd. And finally, rooms are filling up quickly. Workshops are getting completely full for that conference in Chicago. Yes, it is the SMAC Conference, June 23rd to 26th. Marcus, thank you so much for suggesting this Cochrane Review. I think we've done it in a very timely part of the year when everybody is, you know, seeing patients present this way. And you know what? In the end, I think it was worth going through those 500 plus pages.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I hope you got your flu shot.
Of course I got the flu shot. I'm Bat Doc. Oh, there, I gave away my secret identity. Marcus, as the guest skeptic, would you please give the SGM tagline?
Of course. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it here on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.